Gospel Radio Network. We're certainly thankful that you're able to tune in with us today as we are live from beautiful Mount Vernon, Texas, enjoying a wonderful spring, not quite yet summer morning, but the sun is shining and maybe a few places are starting to dry out. While we appreciate the rain, I know many places in Texas are ready for a little catch-up time. Mm-hmm. But we're thankful that we can be together. I'm your host this morning, Ryan Smithy, joined in today with Chip Horton.
Hey, y'all.
And Chip is even happier this week. He's enjoying his first week of break, I think, in the summer vacation from the school bus, and so his nerves are a little lessened. And,
amen.
But no, many are starting in that summer break time. Summer camps have started. Summer youth series got off to a wonderful start last night.
Amen.
Here in Northeast Texas, we were at Talco, and look forward to continuing that each Monday night through the summer. And other areas have started as well. I know out there in Central Texas, if you can make it out to Bangs, Texas tonight, the congregation there will be hosting their first Summer Youth Series event, and it begins at 7 tonight there at the Bangs congregation. But we'll make mention of a few of the other upcoming events hopefully at the end of the program today. But we want to get right started in Acts chapter 23 this morning. Acts chapter 23, and seems odd in one way. I think the study has really reminded us, or reminded me anyway, that we're almost halfway through the year, and here we find ourselves approaching the end of Acts, and just how much of the New Testament is actually contained here in the Gospel accounts and the book of Acts, and how much this is consumed it. But it makes sense when we stop and think about it. Here's the founding and that early history of the church and its spreading. As we move forward, coming out of Acts, we're getting into those epistles. Here's the instructions primarily to the church and it continuing. And so we keep that pattern in our mind, but we're marching forward here specifically in the life of Paul. And these two or three chapters that we've been in and will continue in, I think the word was used yesterday, but cliffhanger.
Yeah, right.
Comes to mind. Really, the beginning of this chapter backs up into the previous one, and in these two or three chapters, this has happened. It's like the end of one chapter sets the stage for the next, and so if we were just to give a quick summary here, we could go back and just think about chapter 21, where Paul has come to Jerusalem, and it's there that he is going to be charged by the people. There's this tumult, this uproar, such that the captain of the guard, as it were, is going to come and drag Paul away. And it's as he's doing that that he asks for pause and the ability to address the audience as a whole, and so that sets the stage for chapter 22, and chapter 22 gives us that address before the people, before again the idea that he expresses what he's doing, and he comes to the point where he says, "And so I took the gospel to the Gentiles, and the uproar started all over again." He's taken within, and there is commanded to be beaten by way of investigation, and there Paul will appeal to his citizenship, and so that beating is stopped before it even really has a chance to begin there, and command is made that the Jewish leaders appear and have the opportunity to sit down with Paul. Mm-hmm. And so instead now, because it's found out that Paul is a Roman citizen, instead of this beating, let's just sit down together, figure out what's going on, seems to be the next approach of the captain here. And so that's bringing us into chapter 23. If I could, I want to take one moment and appreciate something, and it's probably the star out of what I thought about as I studied for this chapter. And it was an idea that was presented by Wayne Jackson, and I don't know that it was even necessarily original with him, but the idea that the Jews had a purpose of trying to silence Paul, that's what they're doing through here, and yet what they have done is given him audience.
Mm-hmm.
Here he's had the opportunity to address the crowd. He's already, or now as we come into chapter 23, he's going to have again the opportunity to address the council. And these events are precipitating Paul's eventual trip to Rome. But it's because of their desire to silence him that they're actually giving him opportunity to speak to not just the crowds of people, but kings and rulers, and are going to help facilitate him on his road to Rome, where he's going to have opportunity even to speak with those of Caesar's household. And so that event really struck out to me, and we could talk about the providence of God. We could talk about the futileness of man's plan when you try to stand against God and against what's right. But think about those events that are occurring or unfolding before us here because of these things. And certainly great opportunities that Paul is taking advantage of here to speak the truth and to proclaim the gospel to all that he has opportunity to do so. Let's just jump right in, and Jim, if you don't mind, maybe about verse 1 through 10, as he has the opportunity to address this this gathering.
Okay. And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Then said Paul unto him, God shall smite thee, thou whited wall, for sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law? And they that stood by said, revilest thou God's high priest? Then said Paul, I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. But when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called into question. And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees part arose and strove, saying, we find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. And when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down and to take him by force from among them and to bring him into the castle."
Okay, and so here's that opportunity. Not a lot found out on this occasion, but as he has opportunity here, to stand before this council. It says, backing up to even verse 1 there, Paul earnestly beholding the council, and it's this idea, this isn't just glancing around. He's looking at them with this almost riveted gaze here as he looks upon them, possibly studying them. Some have wondered even how many of these people Paul knew. From his earlier life when he was persecuting the Christians, before he became a proclaimer of the gospel, it may be that there are those even here that Paul's wondering, we've stood side by side before, you know me, and now they are even seemingly calling for his death. But he begins to speak, and he is telling them that he has lived in all good conscience before God unto this day.
Mm-hmm.
And would to God that everyone could make that kind of statement.
Amen.
Even in my own life, I can look back and if there are those times that I wish, you know, you could almost play repeat and redo a few things of our lives. Sometimes those events have led us to greater opportunities and maybe have turned out for the best, but there are opportunities of our life where we haven't done that, which we knew to be right, But as we look at the Apostle Paul, I think we really get to see a glimpse into his heart.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, I don't think I'd be stretching it too much to in that way, almost compare Paul to David. He was a man who thought of himself as a man after God's own heart. Because even as we look back at his life, so many of the things that he did out of a great zealousness for God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at times he was misguided, misdirected. He didn't understand what that should have been, but he wanted to be pleasing unto God. And so he's not saying that he lived a sinless life, certainly. He's not saying he always made the right decisions, but he always did that which he thought to be right. And therein, in and of itself, is a great warning in our lives. Sometimes people will say, let your conscience be your guide.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what Paul had done, but his conscience wasn't always right. His conscience said that he should persecute Christians. His conscience said that he should do everything that he could to destroy the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did that. He was zealous towards God, but it was not according to knowledge. And that's where we come up with that idea, or we'll hear it said from time to time, while your conscience may be your guide, your conscience has to be educated, or it has to be trained.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we know what's right, then we may be thinking we're doing something right, but we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And therein lies the importance of being students of the Word of God. How in do we know the mind of God except to get into his revelation, wherein he has revealed his mind and his will? And so there we get to learn about God. There we get to learn about what's right in his sight. There we get to learn about how to please him. And so when we know those things, then having a trained conscience, it gives us that sense of what really is right or wrong. And so Paul is speaking here, and the force, I understand, he says, I have lived. Here is a past activity that is continuing. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that I have done and I am continuing to do. And so we should have that same attitude. And when we have that attitude, then when we read the Word of God and we find that there's something amiss in our lives, we're going to want to change it.
Mm-hmm.
When we have that attitude and the preacher gives a sermon that, as it were, we'll use the expression of the day, steps on our toes or cuts to the heart,
mm-hmm.
We're going to make the change rather than just bow up and get mad at the preacher. And so that's what Paul is trying to show them in his life.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you may be mad at me for what I'm doing, but all that I'm trying to do is serve God acceptably. And throughout many of his speeches, that's what I see in these few chapters, mm-hmm. is to try to get them to understand you're upset, but I'm doing God's will.
Right.
But that's not what they wanted to hear.
You know, I was reminded in that particular thought that you brought up of Apollos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as I can tell, the scripture shows that he was teaching, you know, the baptism of John in all good conscience.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't aware, you know, of what he was about to be shown by Aquila and Priscilla. But as soon as, you know, as soon as he was told, my understanding is that he went right into teaching the right thing, mm-hmm. and doing the right thing. And those individuals that we find out had been taught the baptism of John even after the day of Pentecost, you know, they did the same thing. They were immersed for the right reason, for the right, under the right authority. So that should be the same thing with us. You know, I could be living in all good conscience thinking that red is actually blue.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these days somebody finally shows me, no, in fact, it's recorded that this is not red.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of things are that way. And the same thing that we found, you know, in an earlier study last week, we had the opportunity to look at the idea that you can't learn wrong and be baptized right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so when we find out you know, what is the truth, we have to be willing to accept it.
Right. And especially, you know, Paul and Apollos there are good examples of two men that in many ways never missed a beat. And I think that's what I appreciate about them. You know, they're marching in one direction and somebody says, hey, we need to make a steering correction here. And so they turn, they make the correction, and they keep on marching just as forcefully as they were before. And they don't become discouraged. They don't quit or give up or get mad. They just do what's right and keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
So as he begins, one can only assume this was just the beginning of his speech. He's barely making his introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And here, Ananias, who is serving as the high priest, commands those that are standing by to slap Paul.
Mm.
You know, here we're standing for the purpose of finding out what's going on. Not really a courtroom scene, but close enough. And here, before anything has really gotten started, the high priest is commanding that Paul be slapped on the mouth, basically. And Paul... it's interesting here to look at his response as he speaks to him and he says, God is going to smite you, you whited wall. Here is essentially the idea of a hypocrite is what he's calling him. And for the very reason, he says, you sit to judge me after the law and you command me to be smitten contrary to the law.
That's right.
You could reference back there about Deuteronomy 25, verse 1 and 2, but the idea here that he needs to have his case judged before he meets out some kind of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And here he hasn't even listened to the case. And so he says, you're showing your hypocrisy on this very floor today. And so God is going to judge you. Whether this is some form of immediate judgment that... indeed, I think it's Josephus that does record that he was later deposed from his office. There was this sense of judgment that was going to come upon him. We don't know exactly maybe what Paul thought of here, or just the sense that, you know, you're sitting as judge, but you need to remember that one day you're going to sit before the great judge.
Mm-hmm.
And that may simply be his response there. But he shows that hypocrisy. And others are going to call upon Paul and ask, well, why are you reviling God's high priest? He's sitting here serving in that office. And Paul makes an interesting response that there's been a lot of discussion on over the years. And he says, I did not know that he was the high priest. Because it's written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. Many different things have been said. There's arguments in many different directions. Some have said, well, Paul just spoke out of turn, maybe in a moment of anger, maybe in a moment of this kind of flash response. He spoke off at the tongue. Others will point out and ask us to consider, did not Jesus promise to be with the apostles,
mm-hmm.
and to give them answer when they stood before kings and rulers and other mm-hmm. such people? And so those are certainly some questions that we have to consider. Was he apologizing for what he said? Did he not mean what that he had said, that God was going to judge him and pointing out his hypocrisy, are certainly all questions. I am going to suggest to you the idea that I certainly lean to most strongly, and it may be simply the idea that even in Paul's continued response, he's still showing almost this idea of hypocrisy, because Ananias is sitting as the high priest, but he's not acting like one.
Mm-hmm.
Already, that Jewish system has been rebuked. That is, I don't know exactly how I'll put this the right way, but While it is ultimately destroyed in AD 70 with the destruction of Jerusalem and those temple records and all of those things that as we call it, that Jewish economy will fall. But nevertheless, the law and all of its attendant pieces have been fulfilled with the death of Jesus on the cross. It's time for the church and the New Testament. And so those Jewish systems, as it were, have been replaced. That office has been replaced. But also Josephus points out for us that Ananias was a very corrupt ruler. He was known as one who was a wealthy and yet arrogant, unscrupulous ruler. And it may simply be here that Paul is pointing out the fact that he does not recognize him as high priest.
Mm-hmm.
The word here is the word for a no could be that form of acknowledge. Mm-hmm. I don't acknowledge. I still don't acknowledge that man as high priest. Mm-hmm. And so here he's looking at that situation. I don't know, Chip, if you have any thoughts or input there, but that's the. Maybe the how I understand it best.
Well, that makes perfect sense, but I might add to that another idea, and that is you kind of think maybe this big crowd and the big audience, it might have at least a little bit to do with proximity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, when I look across a crowd, you know, I may not be able to recognize you mm-hmm. in a crowd, but, you know, the idea of this evil Ananias, I don't see that as corrupt of a guy as he was, shown by Josephus and others, even elected by Herod, for crying out loud. That was all wrong, too. But I don't, knowing the character of Ananias, I don't see why he wouldn't have hit him himself.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, if it was perhaps proximity and he couldn't see over the crowd or whatever, didn't recognize him for whatever reasons, maybe failing eyesight or something, I don't know. But that's something that entered into my mind,
sure.
You know, because he hollered out for somebody else to slap him, mm-hmm. you know. And anyway, I just thought about, I mean, everything that you said is right on spot. Don't recognize someone that's not elected of God.
You're right. But that's certainly the case, too. In other letters, he will talk about some of his eyesight problems, it seems. And so that is one as well that serves as possibility. And so I would urge caution there. While there is some reasoning we can go through, since the Scripture doesn't charge Paul with acting foolishly mm-hmm. or being abrasive, I would be cautious in saying that Paul acted out of turn.
Yeah.
Because there are some reasonable explanations that might be leveled there as to his speech and to his response.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think he shows that level of respect that he's going to do that which is right in the sight of God. And there at the end of verse 5, when he talks about the law and how it is written, not speaking evil of the ruler of thy people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as he looks then, one might begin to understand that Paul thinks, possibly, I'm not going to get anywhere with this crowd. He recognizes in many ways their division. You have Sadducees and you have Pharisees that are opposing forces one to another, and yet they've come together against a common enemy at this point, which is Paul. And possibly here, again, in order to defend or protect himself, what's the best way to defuse the situation? Turn those enemies back against one another.
Mm.
And that is potentially what he's doing here when he looks out and he will see that the council is split, and he says, I'm a Pharisee. Going back to his, if you will, pedigree, that's how he had been brought up, that's how he was raised, that's what he had served as. I'm called here because of the hope of the resurrection. And certainly there was that part of the charge. Paul's preaching the gospel out of that hope of the resurrection. It could be that he is simply trying to just turn them against themselves so as to draw attention away from himself. But we see the result of it there in verse 7, that a dissension is going to begin arising so that the whole multitude was divided. The Sadducees, who were said there was no resurrection, there's no angels, there's no spirit. The Pharisees believed in those things, and so there's this great cry, this tumult's arising again. And I think too, you mentioned there this proximity and crowd and everything. And this isn't a calm conference room type setting.
Right.
This is still practically a mob scene that is going on. And so the Pharisees' part will rise up and say, "We find no evil in this man," particularly concerning that matter, that he's speaking these things. And so this dissension is arising. And again, this isn't just whisperings, but this is such a tumult that the chief captain is fearing that Paul might be pulled into pieces. This isn't a friendly dispute.
No.
This is, again, an all-out battle, a clamor that is arising between these groups. And so once again, Paul is taken into custody, brought back into the castle. And you almost have to feel badly for the captain of the guard here. What do I do? I don't understand what's going on. I can't even bring Paul out to be tried because they're clamoring practically for his death, and I fear for the safety of Paul. So you have to be wondering already, what is he going to do with this man? Maybe even Paul himself is beginning to wonder what is going to happen. How are we going to move on from this? Where is this all going? And you've already had some rough day or two here with these charges. But notice what's told to Paul here for us in verse 11.
Verse number 11. I was over here in another scripture, brother.
No, if you've got a comment, go ahead and add it in there for us.
I hate to lag behind. I didn't want to skip over that mention of the scribe. You know, these scribes, these individuals that were well-trained in the law because of their writing it over and over again, says we don't need to be fighting against God. And I was thinking back to Acts 5, where my finger is here. Where Gamaliel would say the same thing, really. He says, refrain from these men and let them alone, for if this counsel or this work be of men, it'll come to naught. But if it be of God, you cannot overthrow it. And that sounds a whole lot like what the scribes are screaming out right now. You're picking the wrong fight here, you know.
and we're going to see that unfold. You know, you're fighting against Paul, and yet You're going to lose, and Paul's going on, and even to greater things.
But back to verse 11, and the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome."
Okay, and so maybe you're there with Paul, and you can imagine having to be a part of these proceedings and just not even knowing what the next day is going to hold. And here is, we're told here in verse 11 that the Lord would stand by him. What a great encouragement. We know that there were other occasions, 2 Timothy 4, verse 16 and 17 there, Paul will speak of a time in which he said, "At my first offense, no one took my part. Everyone forsook me. May it not be laid to their account, but the Lord stood by me and strengthened me." And so even when it can seem as if nobody knows what you're going through or nobody's on your side, if you're standing for what's right, the idea ought to comfort us that the Lord is with us. And so he brings him a personal message there. Be of good cheer. Be of good courage. And again, those who know more than I suggest there, we might read that as keep up or maintain your good courage. Don't become discouraged now. Why? Because I still got great work ahead for you. You've been a witness to me in other areas. You're going to bear witness to me in Rome as well. And I'm not sure that I even oftentimes have appreciated those charges. But when the Lord is telling you something's going to happen in your life, You may not know exactly how to get from point A to point B, but you can know that you're going to get there. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what a great comfort that was to Paul as he's going to find out his life is threatened. Can you imagine almost sitting back and say, well, that's another challenge to overcome, but I know they're not going to be successful because I've still got work to do. The ship is going to be blast about, and we'll get to there, but I don't have to worry about that. I'm going to get to Rome. I don't know how what's going to happen between here and there, but I'm going to get to Rome. And so what a comfort this had to have been to Paul, not just that he was going to reach that point, but this is a fulfillment of a of Paul's prayer. Mm-hmm. He had longed that he could go to Rome. It was his great desire. And this wasn't necessarily maybe how he intended to go.
Yeah, right.
Maybe he was thinking of some of his missionary journeys. But nevertheless, he's going to Rome, though it might be in chains or under bondage. But he's going to get to go to Rome. And so it's probably a great encouragement here to him.
You know, it's easy to be overcome with fear. You know, we in this day and age, we can't imagine what it's like to be run out of town, and fearing for your life and let down in a basket by a wall, in Damascus and these things. And so you look to places like Acts 18, beginning of verse 9, where he says, "Be not afraid, but speak and hold not thy peace, for I'm with you." How much people in this city, same thing that you mentioned, even up in Acts chapter 27, he's constantly given comfort. Jesus, before he left, said, "I'm with you always." Mark 16, verse 20, the Lord working with them, And so that's a comfort to any of us, even in this day and time, but certainly to Paul.
Right. And he's going to need it. And again, probably there, the foresight and the providence of God, knowing that Paul was going to need some fortification because he's about to get some bad news, as it were. And let's go ahead and read the plot and its foil let's go verse 12 through verse 25.
All right. "And when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. And there were more than 40 which had made this conspiracy. And they came to the chief priests and elders and said, 'We have bound ourselves under a great curse, that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. Now therefore, ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though you would inquire something more perfectly concerning him, and we, or even he, come near, are ready to kill him.' And when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, 'Bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath a certain thing to tell him.' So he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, 'Paul, the prisoner, called me unto him and prayed me to bring this young man unto thee, who has something to say unto thee.' Then the chief captain took him by the hand and went with him aside privately and asked him, 'What is that thou hast to tell me?' And he said, 'The Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire somewhat of him more perfectly. But do not thou yield unto them, for they, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat or drink till they have killed him. And now are they ready, looking for a promise from thee.' So the chief captain then let the young men depart and charged him, 'See thou tell no man that thou hast showed these things to me.' And he called unto him two centurions, saying, 'Make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen 80, and 10, and spearmen 200, and in the third hour of the night, and provide them beasts that they may set Paul on, and bring him safe unto Felix the governor.' And he wrote a letter after this manner."
Okay. Rather a large section there, but a lot is covered quickly there. As you think about, we're reminded of two things, at least, that come immediately to my mind, and one is the hatred that has developed between the Jews and Paul. Here they would do anything to stop him. And here we find especially there are some unscrupulous characters that would certainly do anything in order to silence him. And so because he has gone against what they believe, even though he's doing what's right, it doesn't jive with what they think. It doesn't align. And so they're willing to even commit themselves unto this vow, this curse, as it's called. Basically, this vow that says it's either him or us. Mm. Somebody's going to die. And are willing to create this scheme in order to make that happen. But then, too, I'm reminded again of the care of God and his control, even of this situation. How these things folded out, I don't know. How this nephew just happened to be in the right place to be able to hear of these events, I don't know. We'd like to know a lot more about that nephew. Was there some reason that he was maybe in some of these council chambers? Was he himself a Christian? What did he go on to accomplish? We simply don't know the answer to any of those questions. But again, I would highlight the providential care of God for Paul, that he was protecting him. And so this conspiracy, they came together, have sworn themselves together to this oath that they are going to kill Paul. But they want the council's agreement in this. They need their help. Right now, remember, Paul is in the safety of the guard. And so we need some reason for him to be brought out. We can't get in to attack him in the castle. So if you could come up with a reason to bring him out, if you could ask the guard tomorrow to bring him out so that you might question him further or have some question concerning the law, then we'll be somewhere along that path. And we'll be ready to kill him.
Such nice people.
Yes. And, you know, you might say, well, the council didn't come up with this plan. No, but the council was willing to go along with it,
yeah, buddy,
knowing what was going to happen. And it kind of skipped over there even the idea of this vow, of the strength of it, that you had these 40 men that bound themselves together and said, we're not going to eat or drink until Paul's dead. I wonder if there were 40 funerals here in about a week, or they changed their mind. But at any rate, they put themselves under this vow, and as they relay that to the council, here is a nephew, Paul's sister's son, heard of what they had planned, what they wanted to do, and will find his way into the council to tell Paul, which of itself may not have been an easy task. I can only imagine that Paul was likely well guarded because of the activities that have taken place over the course of the last day or two. But he gets there, he gets to tell Paul what's happening. And I appreciate Paul's calmness. Maybe it was because of the strength that he received the night before. I don't know, but he shows great wisdom, calling the centurion, asking him to take this nephew before the chief captain. The chief captain willing to hear. And I also have to wonder, maybe it's because he's a Roman citizen and he's affording Paul some great privilege there. Maybe it's because even he can already begin to understand there's nothing worthy of death in Paul. This is some disagreement that has gotten blown out of proportion. And I'm trying to think through his mind. And so he's wanting to protect Paul, recognizing he's not worthy of death. And so he listens to the man and to this plan and this urging there of verse 21. Don't listen to them. Don't do this thing. And it's also interesting to me that Paul and the nephew really are just asking for the plan to be known. It's the centurion or this captain of the guard that's going to come up with the plan by which he's going to get Paul out of the city. And so he begins to he tells the young man not to relay this, but the captain there is going to come up with a plan to get ready this great force of 400 men to guard one prisoner and escort him out of the city. And so he comes up with a plan to have this armed escort to transport Paul to Caesarea. And there the Roman governor presided. Just think of that force of 200 foot soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen that are going to come together and protect Paul in this escort out of the city. And so they have this plan about 9 o'clock in the evening. Remember, the council wants to call Paul the next day. And so about 9 o'clock that evening, under the kind of cover of darkness there, they will begin their journey out of the city. And so here he's going to be taken to the hands of Felix. And again, what have they tried to do? They've tried to silence Paul. And what they've actually done is they're going to give him another audience, another one to speak before. And so, you know, not necessarily a lot of detail there, but we do get to see, again, that hatred and that care of God. Anything to add in that section?
I'm always amazed as we have the opportunity to study together, you know, the beauty of the Scriptures. And I couldn't help but stop and think how that God has always been able to use anyone and everyone for his purpose. Even as Habakkuk would stand before God and he'd say, "Are you not listening? How long are you going to let this go on?" And God's response is, "Don't worry, I'm sending the Chaldeans." You know, and Habakkuk's like, "Who? You got to be kidding me, right?" And so, you know, God would use Babylon. God would use Syria. God, in his great wisdom, just continues to amaze us as we look through the Scriptures. And here, you know, as he would use these individuals to guard, you know, here we see, you know, the reference that I made of, you know, carrying Israel into captivity. That was for punishment, for chastisement, you know, that they would learn and they would have an opportunity to be chastened. And so that's one side of the pendulum swing. And now you look at the other side, how he's using, you know, this centurion and his band to protect his servant. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm constantly amazed as I look down and, you know, was it Daniel 4, where he says he sets them up and he puts them down. You know, he's completely in charge. And this is just another one of those instances where I sit back and have to say, absolutely, he is completely in charge. That it's continued to be shown to us, you know, even in something like this that I might have skipped over and not seen that. But God is wholly in charge.
And that is an amazing thought there, to think that here is really what is rapidly becoming even more corrupt of a nation and an empire, the Roman Empire, and yet they're having to use their resources to protect God's servant. And this wasn't a cheap operation. You're having to pay for 400 men. That's not going to come cheaply, and yet that expense is paid for Paul. But what do you do with a prisoner as you're sending him to someone else? What do you write in that letter? And that's his next concern here in verse 26 through 30.
Claudius Lysias unto the most excellent governor Felix sendeth greeting. This man was taken of the Jews and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army and rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. And when I would have known the cause whereof they accused him, I brought him forth into their council, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. And when it was told me how that the Jews laid wait for the man, I sought straightway to thee and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell.
All right. And so I think we see there that propaganda and politics are nothing new.
Right.
Of course, he has done a great work, but he has certainly tried to put himself in the best light. And so here's Paul. He's being sent to Felix, but Lysias, this captain of the guard here, needs to have something that he can say. I mean, I can't just send a prisoner for no charge or no reason. And so he begins to tell him a little bit of what has happened. Fairly probably common greeting here, just the this most excellent would have been just a proper greeting, but also shows respect unto his office. Antonius Claudius, later known here as just simply Felix, was the Roman procurator of Judea from AD 52 to 60. And we have come to know him through the book of Acts. He himself was an unscrupulous ruler, and it was reported of him by Tacitus to say that he reveled in cruelty and lust. He wielded the power of a king with the mind of a slave, who himself was reported to have been a slave, and so he brought that into his rule. He had that mindset. And but here, anyway, is who he's going to be sent before. Lysias, this guard or this chief captain, is going to, again, speak highly of himself in this letter. This man was taken by the Jews. He was about to be killed, and I was the hero that swept in at the at just the right moment, and I rescued him. And I understood that he was a Roman. I'm not going to tell you that I put him in bonds and I was about to whip him, but we found out that he was a Roman. And I tried to find out of the cause that he had been accused. And so I brought him to the council, and it seems to be a question of their law, but there was nothing worthy of bonds. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paul is very similar to, in this sense, not quite the same, but I would relate it back to Jesus. How many times did the rulers understand Jesus had done nothing worthy of death, mm-hmm. and the trial should have ended right there? Here, all of these Roman officials are going to understand Paul has done nothing worthy of death. Mm-hmm. This is more a question concerning their law, and yet to appease the people, they're allowing these things to go forward. And I think we see that even here in this letter, that this really should have been dismissed. He should have been granted safety and allowed to go on, but they have progressed, likely because of trying to appeal or appease the Jews. And so I found out of this attack that was planned, and I straightway sent him to you, and also gave a commandment to the accusers that they needed to travel and accuse him before you. And so this is going to buy a little bit of time. They're going to have to travel, make some more formal charges. But that is the letter that was relayed.
Sounds a little bit like Jesus' trial, doesn't it? Pilate to Herod, Herod to Pilate, and back
just,
and forth.
Just passed around, and to some degree, nobody really wants the case. Nobody right. wants the charges here to be dealt with. But we see his safe arrival now in verse 31 through the end of the chapter.
Then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. On the morrow, they left the horsemen to go with him and returned to the castle, who, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was, and we understood that he was of Cilicia. "I will hear thee," said he, "when thine accusers are also come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall.
Okay, and so this just tells us of his safe travel. Would have been probably an all-night trip of some 60 miles that they will travel from Jerusalem to Caesarea. They have come to a city some 35 miles outside of Jerusalem, considering themselves to be at a safer distance from the city. The foot soldiers, the spearmen, will all return, but that's left them with some 70 horsemen that will continue on to Caesarea with Paul, who, remember, he himself had been granted even a horse to ride on. I believe we have read that back in verse 24. And so even he has, you know, that that luxury provided. But they can continue on the some 30, 25 miles or so from there on to Caesarea. And they will present this letter that has been written. And Felix will read it and decide to hear the case himself. And so he is kept under guard. He's still basically here a prisoner, but is going to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. It's noted here of some of the great palaces that that Herod had built. And so he will wait there for about 5 days. We're going to find out in next verse, chapter 24 and verse 1, that it was after 5 days the elders will come to make their case or to make their charge. And so there's the cliffhanger again for us that we want to hear the rest of the story, but you're going to have to be patient, and Chip and Richard, Lord willing, we'll get into that tomorrow. But anything you want to add maybe to the end there of the safe passage or of the chapter as a whole?
Well, just maybe the column reference that some of our listeners see in their Bibles there, that Acts 21 and verse 39, where Paul says, you know, he was a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, Syria, of no mean city, or citizen, rather, of no mean city. You know, he had acknowledged that before, and we were aware of that. And so this evidence would be shown unto Felix. And ultimately, tomorrow we'll get to, Lord willing, see the gospel preached to Felix in Drusilla.
And so, again, we appreciate your being with us. We're enjoying this study. I know I am, and I've heard from others. Enjoying the study as we continue through the New Testament, and particularly here through the book of Acts, such a rich history of the early church here. And so we look forward to that continued study together. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow for chapter 24. Do want to take a few moments here as we close out to remind you of some current and ongoing events. This week there is a gospel meeting at the, a Vacation Bible School at the Blossom Church of Christ in Blossom, Texas. And that begins, or continues, tonight and tomorrow night at 7. And so if you're in that area, hope that you can be with them. They also are hosting our next Summer Youth Series Monday night at 7. And going to be talking about reclaiming the word marriage as God defines it. Also want to remind you of the ongoing and upcoming camp sessions at Camp Ida. Invite you to visit campida.com, and there you'll be able to find the schedules, the application forms for campers and for staff, and find out more information there. We're made aware of a gospel singing that's going to be July 15th at the Oak Grove Church of Christ, just north of Mount Pleasant, Texas, and hope that you can join them beginning at 7 p.m. on Friday, July 15th. Deadlines are rapidly approaching for the Southwest Servants Academy and Foundations. Both are occurring the week of June the 25th. And we'll be here in just a few weeks. And so if you've not made plans, contact the Memphis School of Preaching at msop.org or the Southwest School of Bible Studies at swsbs.edu. SWSBS, Southwest School of Bible Studies, .edu. And from there, you'll be able to find out more information about both of those great programs, how to register, who to contact. And they are likely filling up very quickly. And so if you have opportunity, certainly encourage you to check out those two programs as quickly as possible. And so those are some of the things that are going on in addition to other summer camps and summer youth series and other such things. Certainly pray for the safety of many as they travel about. And we have such an active summer And we appreciate those prayers and those for those efforts and for the safety of those that are participating in them. And so with that, we're going to sign off for the day. Again, thankful that you've been able to join us, and hope that you'll be with us again tomorrow and continue listening throughout the day for some great programs here on the Gospel Radio Network.
Been listening to Mornings for the Master on the Gospel Radio Network. Remember to join us each weekday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Central Standard Time, or catch the replay at 9 p.m. Central Time. You can also contact us at mornings@tgrn.org if you have any questions we can help you with, or if you have events you would like to submit to our bulletin board, or just with general feedback about the program or network. We would love to hear from you. As we've had opportunity to spend time with the Master this morning in His Word, let's remember His words in Luke 6:46, when He said, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" He goes on to say in verse 47 and 48, "Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, I will show to you whom he is like. He is like a man which built an house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock." Let's show the wisdom of that builder and go now to live for the Master.